usually on the pretext of acknowledging complexity, is cynicism. The Tsar had his own motives. True enough, people do. No doubt he had a number of them. This really does not neutralize the fact that the British and French had their motives, too. By the blunt measure of their potential impact on human lives, these were at best far inferior. We have brought home from our wars, cold and hot, this habit of impervious antagonism, antagonism as loyalty, which dovetails neatly with our version of cynicism, better called intellectual lassitude. We have allowed ourselves to become bitterly factionalized, and truth has lost its power to resolve or to persuade. There is a mystery in the fact that by means of these truth-excluding encapsulations, besides making our society foolish and vulnerable, and in some ways ineducable, we do preserve very effectively negative beliefs about ourselves. My earliest memories take up after World War II, when movie theaters still ran ads about the need to relieve hunger and poverty in war-torn Europe. The camera dwelt on a little boy in short pants and bare legs alone in a dark, narrow street. I remember a German immigrant neighbor, an older woman, who scolded my mother as if from a moral height for the inadequacies of her knitting, for her buying soap when she ought to have been making it. Her houseplants, she said, were a disgrace. My mother was impressed, even deferential, though not to the point of making soap. The neighbor was a product of her moment, a priestess in the cult of Heimat. But we would not have known. There were a number of freshly arrived Europeans then. I remember an old man who practically lived at the mayor's office, and who scolded whomever was polite and could spare a minute with the fact that democracy was wasted on Americans. More generally, I was educated to the belief that this country was an awkward attempt at a civilization, a crude imitation of something profound and elegant and intrinsically elsewhere. Objectively speaking, this is remarkable, considering what was then the very recent history of Europe. Be that as it may, the admiration for things European, whether in any instance it was justified or not, came paired with the implication that nothing so excellent or so profound would be possible here. I've read a good deal of fascist literature over the years, and I know it was believed and taught and spun into philosophy and philology all over the continent that mingled and rootless people who spoke an adopted language could never even know how utterly they fell short of profundity, of authenticity, both important terms of the time. By these lights, such people were a corruption, a threat to the organic integrity of any true culture. A splinter in the flesh, Hitler said. In our deference to European thought, we applied this thinking to our hapless selves and kind, never reflecting on the uses that had been made of it in Europe or the biases it legitimized here. I have never admired deference. I was dosed with Sartre and Artaud, as any college girl then would have been. I felt their nausea. It made an Americanist of me. But for those whose tolerances were different from mine, figures like these defined the future. It was not a very interesting or habitable future, but in the short term it opened the way to study abroad. Juniors returned knowing better how to hold a fork or a cigarette. They had heightened social confidence. They had checked an important box. None of this ends with adolescence, or this adolescence never ends. It seems to be true now that there is no Europe of the kind to potentially unleash new literary trends, or to make us line up around the block for a new French or Italian movie. Without any particular object of emulation to measure our deficiencies by, the sense of deficiency is at least as strong as ever. It is absurd that the products of a civilization as old and solid as this one should forever be such colonials, feeling sophisticated in the fact that they have and confess such deeply internalized prejudices against themselves. A few years ago, I was seated near an American couple at one of those dinners they have at Oxford before a lecture. The Americans were doing something I see very often. They were saying that in the States there were no such events as these, that intellectualism was held in contempt there, and so on. They were earnest and insistent, even a little bit loud. I said, that might be an overstatement. They reacted, again predictably, as if the fact were plain and must be faced. When they were told that I was the lecturer, they were irritated. Not only had they been interrupted mid-kowtow, they had come out for an evening of stimulation among their betters, and they had found me instead. Why do so many otherwise presentable people think they can ingratiate themselves with foreigners by talking this way? I take ingratiation to be part of the motive behind it, or the hope. A small thing in the great scheme, granted, but it enacts as much as it expresses that internalized prejudice. Put aside the notion of country, and imagine 320 million souls who happen to be passing their mortal time on this continent. Why should we discourage them from major aspiration? Say 15% are black, 51% are women. Is it at all consistent with their aspirations to be told that whatever their gifts, an ultimate mediocrity awaits them? I don't know how damaging this really is. I certainly felt the weight of it when I was young. I see students who seem to think they are excused from the kind of effort they might make by the belief that there is no audience in this country for serious literary work, for ideas. Some first-rate writing is being done here now, and finding a readership. Still, I hear again and again that Americans hate books and ideas, that demanding novels don't find publishers. This gloom, which is mutual condescension, is unshakably in love with its certitudes. Then there is the matter of our press, our public discourse, which looks more and more like self-parody. The purport of all the jeering and slurring and scaring seems to be that democracy is indeed wasted on Americans. Well, democracy is my aesthetics and my ethics, and more or less my religion. I am very grateful that my life has passed in a society where the influence of a democratic ideal is sometimes great, sometimes decisive. A thing I have long regretted, though, is that I have been significantly distracted from this privilege and from the experience of my life and the lives around me by generalizations about us all that are meager and belittling at best. When I was still vulnerable to those unanchored comparisons that are always made of us and that we seem always to welcome as truth, I thought we as a culture might be especially materialistic, especially intolerant, especially violence-prone, especially indifferent to the finer things. Now, as I watch this supposed populism that invites some part of the public to identify with all these things as indeed American, as the voice that really is great within us, a sort of utterly corrupted Whitmanism, I fall to wondering how the grand experiment has been brought to such a pass. And this brings me back to history. I am always writing about that broad area that lies between expert opinion and public assumption. It is broad in the sense that it reflects the state of knowledge in far the greater number of people, not at all in the sense that the difference between expert views and public assumptions is typically great. The film Amistad is based on an important event in American history and is intended as a serious treatment of it. In 1840, a Spanish ship carrying African captives in the Caribbean was seized by the captives. The navigators, who were spared so that they could take them back to Africa, misled them and sailed north. They were found off the coast of the United States, arrested, and brought to New Haven, which was an important abolitionist center. This came to the attention of Lewis Tappan, who organized a very distinguished legal defense to clear them of charges, including murder, and to free them. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court. When they won, Tappan arranged for them to return home to Africa. In the film, 19th-century New Haven looks like a set for the Salem witch trials. There are randomly assorted details to suggest a pervasive religiosity. A troop of nuns pass through the street. A close-up shows crosses on chains dangling from Bibles. Simpering black-clad women poke crosses at the Africans through the slats in a picket fence. Puritans, as these people are clearly meant to be, and would have been, more or less, did not dress in black, and did not use crosses, which they regarded as icons. The Africans, watching black-clad people kneeling in the street outside their jail window in some clumsy and unspecific show of sympathy and evangelism, remark, with subtitles, that they look unhappy. This moment hardly seems necessary, since the cliché is so commonplace that even George H.W. Bush was aware of it. When they fell to thinking about it, a great many New Englanders were indeed unhappy about slavery and about the fugitive slave law, which was germane to this case and which was meant to implicate Northerners in the enforcement of slavery. This is the kind of unhappiness that should be associated with intelligent humanity, not with gloomy fanaticism. But they were Puritans, and therefore, as cliché would have it, cankered souls who simply hated life. I will not pause over the fact that this region at this time was producing a body of literature of great beauty and depth, which is generally considered a sign of cultural health. So, given the conventions that shaped the film, what is to be done with the figure of Lewis Tappan, a great early emancipationist who devoted himself and his fortune to the cause? Among many other things, he was one of the founders of Oberlin College, an institution of singular importance in advancing abolition and in asserting the equality of all races and both genders. In New York City, Tappan's business was burned, his house was ransacked with him in it. He went right on, rather jovially and very constructively, supporting abolition. In the film, he remarks to his black colleague that it would be better for the cause if the Africans were to die. There it is, the stereotypical fanaticism, the inevitable underlying pathology that contaminates what would otherwise be generosity and idealism. There is no truth in this, of course, but it satisfies the expectations of convention and also of cynicism. Movies love the underdog, here a rumpled young lawyer invented to fill this role. But a movie with any claim to historical significance would find the underdog in Tappan and the figures he recruited to the freeing of the Africans. That they were men of standing in their society did not make them powerful against a hostile president or the slave interests in Congress, as the length of this struggle and the larger struggle for emancipation makes clear. The controversy surrounding the Amistad and the determination of the case are very important, so why not give a true account of them? Reality is interesting. Well, for one thing, to do so would disrupt some deeply entrenched notions. Lewis Tappan, that Puritan, used moral and religious language to make his case against slavery. This may mean he was, as they say, holier than thou. I freely concede that he was holier than me, if we are to be judged by our works. Better or easier to reinforce those stereotypes, available as they are, undisputed as they are. Popular culture has its own systems of self-perpetuation. One last thing. There is an idealized Englishman, in the movie a naval officer who destroys a slave castle he has discovered on the coast of Sierra Leone, a place whose existence until then might supposedly have been only rumored. Since Sierra Leone was the center of the British slave trade from the 16th century, when it was sanctioned by Queen Elizabeth, to the early 19th century. This is clearly implausible. But the movie gives us someone to admire, not a taciturn, stoical New Englander, but a taciturn, stoical Briton. We are very accustomed to the idea that qualities that are handsome on one side of the Atlantic are unhealthy, soulless, reprehensible on the other. Puritanical, in fact. The convention is that Puritan culture was stunted intellectually, emotionally, and morally by the religious tradition that also founded Harvard, and of course Yale, to name only local examples of their remarkable institution building and their devotion to learning. Lately, I have been reading and reading about another Puritan, Oliver Cromwell. In his case, the expert view is typically quite different from his popular reputation, to the extent that he can be said to have a popular reputation. So far as he does have a place in the general public's mind, he looms as a giant monolith on the darkest terrain of unhipness, towering over even Edwards and Calvin on that Ultima Thule where the sanctifying words comme il faut are never spoken. Scholarly opinion reflects an awareness of Cromwell's importance to early modern history and a fascination with his essential opacity despite his relatively long and well-documented public career. Cromwell, at age 40, having had no experience to prepare him, joined the Army of Parliament in its war with Charles I. Over time, it became apparent that he had a genius for warfare, especially for the use of cavalry. He rose through the ranks on the basis of great personal courage and an unbroken history of success in combat, attracting and retaining an army that came to be regarded as the preeminent military power in Europe. Through all this, he remained dutifully subordinate to his commander, Lord Fairfax, and after the death of Fairfax, to Parliament. Over time, his new model army became an interest and a political force in its own right. Finally, Cromwell emerged, in a country profoundly disrupted by years of civil war, as head of state. For about 10 years, England experimented with forms of republican or commonwealth government. After Cromwell died, his son and successor proved unable to govern, and the monarchy was restored. All this is of interest because it might be called the beginning of American history. Those abolitionists in New Haven were the cultural and in many cases literal descendants of the supporters of Cromwell, who came here in search of religious freedom, as we often say, without elaboration. The English civil wars tend to be known, if they are known at all, for the trial and execution of the reigning king, Charles I. Granting that the trial can hardly be said to have made the legally difficult case that the king was, or could be, guilty of treason as the law then stood, and granting that decapitation is an ugly fate, neither of these was crude or cruel by the appalling standards of the time. Nor, for that matter, by comparison with the French Revolution, which came more than a century later, and which, though it was closely modeled on the English example, utterly exceeded it in vindictiveness and bloodshed. In any case, among the king's judges, called regicides, 3 were sheltered in New Haven, and 1 was buried there. Others, who did not escape England, suffered the superfluous death, too ghastly to describe, which was the usual fate of condemned traitors, and which the king had been spared. Connecticut was a natural refuge for those fleeing the suppression of the Commonwealth side after the Restoration. A colony had been founded there in 1635, before the outbreak of war in England. According to the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, Saybrook was planned as a settlement to which for a time it was thought Lord Say and Sell, Lord Brooke, Oliver Cromwell, and other independents would immigrate. Independents are more commonly called Puritans. So the seeds of radicalism and revolution were planted on our soil almost a century and a half before independence. Then again, American history may have had an earlier beginning yet. There was a period of reform and unrest during the brief reign of the boy King Edward VI, who ascended the throne at the age of 9 and died when he was 15. As the successor to his father, Henry VIII, he came to the throne in a time of turbulence. The Church of England had rather newly been severed from Rome. With the radical exception of the king's having put himself in the place of the Pope, Henry VIII intended a minimum of change in theology and practice when he broke with the Catholic Church. But the Reformation was at its height on the continent, and Edward VI, who passed seamlessly from tutelage to precocity, and who was fluent in many languages and a devoted student of scripture and theology, attempted to model his church and society on European examples. This meant a great destruction of art, prayer books, and ritual objects. It meant also a great relaxation of censorship laws, with a consequent explosion of publishing, much of it of religious literature, though early vernacular works such as Piers Plowman also enjoyed great popularity. It meant that the laws dating back to Richard II that punished heresy with death were repealed, and with 2 exceptions, the burning of people as heretics ended while Edward lived. This was a radical departure from the practice of his father. While the stripping of the churches is often treated as harsh and Philistine, the disuse of the stake and gallows is never discussed in aesthetic terms, though surely it should be. Edward repealed as well most laws concerning treason. He was succeeded by his half-sister Mary, who reversed these reforms. This child king, beloved as he seems to have been by the people, was given no tomb. According to the historian Dermot McCulloch, his grave is marked only with a simple modern slab. My 1911 Britannica has little to say about him, none of it kind. Rumors that he was alive persisted for years after his death, and it is good they were false, the article says, for Edward showed signs of all the Tudor obstinacy, and he was a fanatic into the bargain, as no other Tudor was except Mary. Attacks on the child began early. In the words of a contemporary, "If ye knew the towardness of that young prince, your hearts would melt to hear him named, and your stomach abhor the malice of them that would him ill. The beautifulest creature that liveth under the sun, the wittiest, the most amiable and the gentlest thing of all the world. Edward was 10 when this was written, and there were already them that would him ill. The convention of blaming the king's advisers for grievances would certainly be plausible here, since his collaborator in these reforms, and surely in part his instigator as well, was his uncle and Lord Protector Edward Seymour, 1st Duke of Somerset. According to the Encyclopaedia Britannica, Somerset's ideas were in striking contrast with those of most Tudor statesmen, and he used his authority to divest the government of that apparatus of absolutism that Thomas Cromwell had perfected. He had generous popular sympathies and was by nature averse to coercion. Somerset's downfall, which led to his execution, is generally considered to have resulted in part from his conciliatory response to Kett's rebellion, an armed popular rising protesting the impoverishment that came with the privatization, that is, the enclosure by landlords, of the common lands that were historically a resource of the poor. Kept apart from all this, apparently, is the issue of religious reform, which is laid to the child king's precocious and intense piety, his fanaticism, though it was marked by that reluctance, entirely untypical of the times and his forebears and his successor, to burn heretics. In The Winter's Tale, Paulina says, "It is an heretic that makes the fire, not she which burns in it." The same critique could be applied to the word fanatic. Surely it is bizarre to harbor historical animosities toward a doomed child. The problem seems to be that, as head of the church, Edward was a Puritan before the word. McCulloch is careful to insist that he and his circle were not Calvinists, offering no grounds for this assertion. Calvin, in fact, corresponded with Edward and Somerset. In one letter, he responds to a request for his advice on completing the reform of English church and society. He dedicated both editions of his Commentary on Isaiah to Edward and sent him a brief commentary on a psalm he thought might interest him. Many particulars of the Edwardian church are consistent with Calvinism. For example, Edward ended the requirement of clerical celibacy and introduced English into the Eucharist. And, tellingly, Thomas Norton, a poet and politician who made the first English translation of Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, was a member of Somerset's household, his secretary, and the son-in-law of Edward's counselor and archbishop, Thomas Cranmer, who also corresponded with Calvin. About Norton, my doughty old Britannica has this to say. Norton's Calvinism grew with years, and towards the end of his career he became a rabid fanatic. After 350 years, the embers were still hot. I am suggesting that a polemic with its origins in American prehistory has more or less expunged, has at least alienated, an important part of our colonial and national history, the part that is appropriately called Puritan. This could not have happened if we had not collaborated in it decisively, of course. Why would we have done this? And why am I perfectly confident that we will persist in it? It can't be the whole problem that when people feel they know who to blame or to snicker at, they seldom feel the need to know more. The alienation of New England from our sympathies has, oddly enough, at the same time made it more or less the epitome of our origins, an enclave of the provincial and fanatical in a world that was by implication reasonable and relatively humane. How many witches had been burned in Britain and Europe before a Puritan set foot on American soil? How many had been burned before the word Puritan was coined? Were there never witch trials in the colonial South? Did only Puritans devote themselves to rigorous piety? It is bizarre that they are isolated by association with attitudes and practices that were, if anything, less characteristic of them than of British and European culture as a whole. The implication that they were exceptional in these things implies that we can simply assume contemporaneous cultures, the American South, for example, may be understood with unspecific reference to a standard of reasonableness that is never to be assumed anywhere. And this erases history that would give context and meaning to a great deal that has been thought and done here, some of it the Puritan impulse toward reform, their passion for education, and their genius for institution building, a heritage of great value. A true genealogy of American Puritanism leads back through the English Revolution, through the brief reign of a tombless and disparaged child, and back farther yet to the masters of the old vernacular style, the Lollards and Wycliffeites, who discovered the beauty of the language of common life and of common life itself, and were the originators of the great dream rehearsed in that language through so many generations. In this light, we can understand John Winthrop and Lewis Tappan as well. The period between the fall and death of Charles I and the restoration of the monarchy in the person of Charles II, the so-called interregnum when England was governed by Parliament and Cromwell, took place at a time when colonies were established in America, firmly enough to have some sense of themselves as societies, and recently enough to feel very intimately involved in English affairs. They were governed under charters granted by the Crown that forbade the establishment of laws inconsistent with what was then, before the Parliamentary Revolution, British law. During the civil wars that engrossed the mother country, and during the protectorate of the Puritan Cromwell, the colonies could only have had an interregnum of their own. England had more urgent demands on its attention, for one thing, and for another, Massachusetts and Connecticut would have been as unanimous in their support of the Puritan side, perhaps, as Cromwell's army itself. Early American history is not my field, but I have read enough, unsystematically, to attach some significance to the fact that I have seen scant mention of the effects of either the wars or the protectorate in New England, immediately important as they were to the American settlement. The severing of British and American history at this point is completely artificial. Men left New England to fight on the side of Parliament and Cromwell. Cromwell's own chaplain was formerly a minister in Massachusetts. Puritanism was a political as well as a religious movement. Indeed, the two were simultaneous. The colonists were moved by beliefs about religion and society that were closely related to those held by Cromwell and his army and by the dissidents in Parliament. There is every reason to note differences of opinion among Cromwell, army, and Parliament, and there is no reason to assume unanimity among any group of colonists. But the English factions hung together well enough to sustain and win two major wars against the Royal Army and the Scots. It is clearly important to acknowledge a high degree of consensus among them, as well as their strong association with New England colonization. As I have said, Cromwell was personally involved in the founding of Saybrook, Connecticut. When that good Englishman John Winthrop spoke in 1630 about the city on a hill, he was appealing to his hearers as people creating a model society whose success or failure would be known to the world. Describing elsewhere the decision to admonish a tradesman for taking an excessive profit on his goods, Winthrop says it was decided that the first of the false principles that had misled the tradesman was that a man might sell as dear as he can and buy as cheap as he can. This admonition was necessary since the man was, says Winthrop, a member of a church and commonwealth now in their infancy, and under the curious observation of all churches and civil states in the world. Such minuteness of attention is only imaginable given the actual frequency of travel to and from New England, and the continuous communication of England with the colonies. It is interesting to consider by what standards the great world was assumed to be judging this new commonwealth. Clearly it is not one that we bother with now, or regard as having any tendency to diminish the brightness of that same city on a hill. In any case, New England, so far from being the isolated refuge of an austere religious minority, was a laboratory for a kind of social order being tried in parts of Europe and soon to be tried in England itself. Winthrop's speech aboard the Arabella anticipates the interregnum by more than a decade. It is only its inexplicable isolation from British and European history that allows it to be read as a very early celebration of an American nation. It is, in fact, a utopian vision of a society whose relations are based on charity, using the word in the biblical sense, meaning love. The religious critique of existing social order from the Puritan side was that it was unbiblical, unchristian, in the fact of its being based on status, wealth, and power, all of which preclude the thoroughgoing mutual liberality Winthrop calls for, using just this word. He was the governor of the colony, and might have been expected to mention the usual texts about how authority is to be honored as an instance of God's providence. Instead, he sees the bonds of society and mutual care and service. This particular vision has a long and deep history in English culture, going back to Piers Plowman and forward to William Blake. It was the vision of the Quakers and the Levellers. Shakespeare pondered it as the regime of his forests and wild places. This is not to say that anarchy, in any sense of the word, lies behind Winthrop's vision, only that the essential primary order for his commonwealth would be a matter of maintaining these bonds of mutual affection. Strictures against profiteering should be thought of in this light, then and now, at least insofar as the health and cohesion of society are valued. Colonies actually governed by British law as it stood before the civil wars were necessarily limited in their options. That they were frustrated in their attempts to legislate for themselves is among the grievances listed in the Declaration of Independence. But in the 17th century, while the monarchy was in crisis, then dissolved, they began to create laws of their own. In practice, these codes did not survive the Restoration, but insofar as they are discoverable, they are evidence of the social theories of the colonists. Given their kinship with the English dissidents, it seems reasonable to suppose that they are also an indication of the thought that lay behind what would be called the Commonwealth, that is, the revolutionary government of Parliament and Cromwell. I have come across references to a code drawn up by the colony of New Haven. I happened to learn about the Massachusetts Body of Liberties of 1641 many years ago from a mention in a letter to the editor in the New York Times. I can't really be sure to what extent the gap in history I sense here is really an artifact of my own lack of thoroughness in looking into the field, but my decades of browsing predispose me to thinking that a subject I have never seen raised or alluded to has probably dropped out of American history. This period, from the point of view of the general public, is a complete blank, except for the few caricatures sketched into it of witches and somber men with buckles on their hats. How much formulating and publishing of laws happened in New England in the Cromwell period, I don't know. After the Restoration, delegates from New England went to London to re-establish their charters. I am glad to have happened upon the Body of Liberties, which is a very interesting document, brief and clear, anticipating the American Bill of Rights and defining liberty in largely negative terms. For example, item 46 says, "For bodily punishments we allow among us none that are inhumane, barbarous, or cruel." Anyone who has any acquaintance with contemporary English or European history knows what a radical departure this is. Cromwell, as Lord Protector, tried to reform what he called the wicked and abominable sentences of the criminal law, but failed to gain the approval of Parliament. The Massachusetts Body of Liberties lists 12 capital crimes: idolatry, witchcraft, blasphemy, premeditated murder, murder in rage, murder by guile — they seem to have wanted to arrive at the number 12, bestiality, sodomy, adultery, kidnapping, false witness against the accused in a capital case, and insurrection or subversion. All of these but the last have warrant of Scripture, which is cited. If this code seems severe by our lights, a bitter consequence of Puritan religious zeal — in fact, it very much limits the list of capital crimes, and in particular, it excludes from the death penalty what were overwhelmingly the crimes of the poor. Under English law, theft and also idleness or vagrancy were punished by hanging. Early American law is always said to be based on English common law, without elaboration. Then either the use of the gibbet in such cases did not accord with common law, but was prevalent all the same, or American practice and theory departed in important ways from this precedent. I looked up common law in my Britannica. The article is brief, one column devoted to this important subject. Common law is, the article says, probably best defined with reference to the various things to which it is opposed. These things are statute law, equity, civil law, canon or international law, and local or customary law as the general law for the whole realm. Quoting further, Blackstone divides the civil law of England into lex script or statute law and lex non-script or common law. The latter, he says, consists of 1. General customs prevailing in certain districts, which are the common law strictly so called, 2. Particular customs prevailing in certain districts, and 3. Laws used in particular courts. Inevitably, the article concludes that common law is the foundation of law in the United States. How anything so amorphous and indefinable could be the basis of anything is a question worth looking into. It is not even the basis of English law, surely, because it can be contravened by these other systems. Occasionally, says the Britannica, the term common law would appear to be used in a sense which would exclude the law developed by, at all events, the more modern decisions of the courts. The notion of common law, which suggests a kind of common decency brought to bear on disputes and transgressions that required public resolution, is hard to discover in practice. I am persuaded at this point that the notion that our legal system is based on it is simply a cliché. There is a kind of English law that serves much better as progenitor, the biblical utopian codes proposed by dissident groups like the Lollards and the Kentish rebels in Kett's Rebellion. It is this nucleus that is to be the basis of the new society whose character and viability will be of such interest to the world. Into the 20th century, there was a body of law called poor law, which very narrowly governed the lives of the mass of the British people. Mention of it is omitted in this Britannica article, though a full 6 pages are devoted to it elsewhere. They deal in grueling detail with pauperism and workhouses, a system still very much up and running in 1910, still taking its ethos explicitly from a statute of Elizabeth I. There is no difficulty whatever in finding evidence of its reality and importance. If it is relevant to the development of American law, it is inversely relevant in that our laws do not include an ordinance of laborers, a special legal system meant to govern the working poor. It is over against its strictures on movement and association that the First Amendment of the Constitution should be understood. That said, poor law does appear to be the basis for laws that protected the institution of slavery in America. The idea of a lex terrae, a law of the land that constrained the king and limited other law, was important in the time of Edward VI, when George Ferrers, a member of his court, first translated the Magna Carta into English. What this famous document ever meant in practice, whether in Latin or in English, is an open question. Poor law, which was national in scope and as nearly uniform as it could be made, seems, however, to have produced a sort of holocaust of the redundant, carried out by legal means over generations. The common folk, who were in law the poor if they lived by their labor, would be unlikely to have endorsed this, they being potentially so vulnerable to it, so helpless in the face of it. As Sir Thomas More pointed out, Moses has no capital punishment for crimes involving property, to which the English poor were often driven. In the body of liberties, the laws of Massachusetts were brought into line with Old Testament law and became relatively modern and enlightened in their biblicism. In this, at least, thank God, we have followed Moses. I can't imagine that he, any more than the Puritans, would find our recent zeal for endless incarceration admirable, though it is marginally less abusive of the poor. New England Puritans are very often said to have aspired to theocracy, even to think they had achieved it. In the first place, it is difficult to imagine a more theocratic arrangement than one that assumed the divine right of the king. Charles I was persuaded that he had no one to answer to but God alone. Then again, if the Pope were granted final authority over every regime in Christendom, this could certainly be described as theocratic as well. 2 liberties in the Massachusetts Code shed light on the question. First, civil authority hath power and liberty to deal with any church member in a way of civil justice, notwithstanding any church relation, office, or interest. In other words, membership or standing in the church should not at all exempt anyone from the ordinary functioning of the law, as clergy have been exempted traditionally. Second, no church censure shall degrade or depose any man from any civil dignity, office, or authority he shall have in the commonwealth. The decisions of a church will not interfere with the workings of civil government or with the standing of anyone as a member of civil society. By the standards of the time, this is an extremely clean separation of church and state, depriving the church of powers to coerce that were still very important elsewhere. These are not the laws of a theocracy, as should be clear by comparison with virtually any other society contemporary with it. In any case, the tendency of historians to treat Puritans as if they were interested in religion in only the narrowest sense, altar or table, communion in one kind or in two, overlooks other scruples, also religious. For example, the Body of Liberties not only forbids horrible punishments, which often involve dismemberment, but also specifies that the body of the executed should be buried within 12 hours. Under Elizabeth, severed heads and limbs were hung on walls and in trees in various places and left there to widen the impact of royal justice, presumably. The heads of Cromwell and 2 men close to him were displayed for decades on pikes over the Palace of Westminster. Cromwell died a natural death, and so was exhumed and executed posthumously. Only a strong wind finally brought his head down from the pike. It might seem a minor courtesy that the head of Charles I had been surgically reattached to his body and that he had been allowed to remain in his grave. Still, a great deal is made of the repressiveness of the Puritan reformation of morals under Cromwell, his attempt to suppress swearing and drunkenness. It is true that he had led a terrifyingly efficient army over the length and breadth of England and into Scotland and Ireland. Certainly he had blood on his hands. But if the Puritan departure from the penal horrors enshrined in law were thought of as a part of the reformation of morals, to me this seems appropriate, since they would spare society as a whole much terror and degradation, the ban on swearing would be comparatively minor, even pardonable. Again, it should be noted emphatically that under Cromwell no one was executed for his religious beliefs. In his letters, Cromwell advocates consistently for freedom of conscience. These would have been important enhancements of the quality of life. It should be noted that the Massachusetts Code does not list heresy among capital crimes, or mention it at all, for that matter. We know the colonists did expel people from their settlements on these grounds. Total reformation never comes at one stroke. Still, on balance, what is often called Puritan intolerance might as fairly be seen as Puritan tolerance. Winthrop says this about the expulsion of Anne Hutchinson. So the court proceeded and banished her. But because it was winter, they committed her to a private house, where she was well provided, and her own friends and the elders permitted to go to her, but none else. So American culture sprang from English dissenters. What has this meant? The Carolinas were colonized after the fall of Cromwell and the Restoration, and named for Charles II, then king. The Fundamental Constitutions of Carolina was drawn up, commissioned by the king, and written, it is said, by John Locke. No doubt the tendency of colonies to legislate for themselves was to be forestalled by this constitution, which would have established an authoritarian class system based on land ownership. It created carefully delineated ranks and degrees and provided invented names for them. Somehow the colonial governor, William Sale, who was a Puritan, never found the right time to put this constitution into effect. It would have created a kind of idealized England from the monarchical point of view, where landholding and authority were fixed and simultaneous. It would have precluded long-standing issues. From the early Middle Ages, the dream of the English poor was secure access to land, which they claimed as a right based in tradition. This access was threatened, and progressively ended by enclosures, the seizing and hedging in, the appropriation for private use, of land that by custom had been available for the use of the community. Enormous flocks of sheep displaced villages, their inhabitants turned out to wander the roads, and in the worst cases to starve or to be hanged for vagrancy. This endless, irresistible disaster was written about in the early 16th century by Moore, and is the context for his Utopia. The first fisherman in Shakespeare's late play Pericles speaks of rich misers, like whales who never leave gaping till they've swallowed the whole parish, church, steeple, bells, and all. Oliver Goldsmith, writing in the 18th century, describes a ruined village where one only master grasps the whole domain, and a landscape where once scattered hamlets rose, but now unwieldy wealth and cumbrous pomp repose. Enclosure was a revolution from above that created abject dependency in the huge class of the poor by seizing commons and excluding the community from the use of this traditional resource. The visionary literature of England idealized the echoing green, the world as it was before this systematic creation of poverty and destruction of the poor, a world modest, joyful, familial, and as if unfallen. This vision remained powerful even as the society urbanized and the loss of the commons became more a symbol of profound discontent than a present grievance for those who involved themselves in protests and uprisings. Englishmen in the New World found a harsh life, one that did not lend itself readily to the Arcadian aspects of this vision. But Puritan New England did have a particular ethos of community of the kind Winthrop urges and celebrates in his Arabella address, which is as indebted to English social history as to Scripture, insofar as the two can be distinguished. Its early exponents were Lollards, after all, in fact or by association. The Earl of Somerset, Lord Protector of Edward VI, was one of a number of wealthy and powerful men who would take the side of those who resisted enclosure. Cromwell seems to have been another. His history, before the age of 40, is very little documented, but during that time he was a modestly substantial landowner, educated in Cambridge, who served in Parliament. His aristocratic connections by blood and marriage, though not direct, were not insignificant either. It was in this earlier period that he was called Lord of the Fens. This was an irony. It seems Cromwell tried to prevent the drainage, therefore the making suitable to conventional farming and enclosure, of land that had sustained a population of the very poor. Before Cromwell, the Protector Somerset had attempted to intervene on behalf of a rising against enclosures called Kett's Rebellion, an attempt that began his fall from power. John Kett himself was a landowner who sympathized with, then led, and finally died in this insurrection. In other words, neither Somerset nor Cromwell was involved in class war as that phrase is normally understood. There were then two contending visions active, both of them believed by their adherents to be based on Scripture, one claiming a basis in antiquity, the other a basis in an ideal primitivity, when Adam delved and Eve span, when Christianity was still pure of accretions. This latter was Puritanism, the tradition of Cromwell's rearing and education, the tradition he helped to establish in Connecticut. The emergence of Cromwell and the relative effectiveness of his government until his death would be difficult to account for if it were the novelty and departure history often suggests. But, first, it was a Calvinist revolution of a kind for which there were earlier precedents in Switzerland and the Low Countries. Second, its ethos and policies had precedents in the reign of Edward VI. While Catholic Mary ruled, many leading Protestants went as refugees to Geneva, including some who had been figures close to Edward. There they produced the Geneva Bible with its reformist notes, the Bible of Shakespeare and of the American colonists, and there they felt very directly the influence of Calvin, whose contempt for monarchy in general seems to have eluded scholarly attention. Many Englishmen went to the Low Countries to fight on the Protestant side, including Sir Philip Sidney, who famously and graciously died there. In other words, there were important models of stable Protestant regimes that had overthrown their traditional rulers, and English people of great influence had the opportunity to study them at length and at close range. The severing of English from European history in this period is as unaccountable as its severing from American colonial history. And of course, the neglect of English history by those who write English history is equally arbitrary. Later, writers give the reign of Edward VI short shrift. But during the Renaissance and Reformation, Fox's Acts and Monuments was the most popular history among contemporaries. Fox says this: "These meek and gentle times of King Edward have this one commendation proper unto them, for that among the whole number of the popish sort, of whom some privily did steal out of the realm, many were crafty dissemblers, some were open and manifest adversaries, yet of all that multitude there was not one man that lost his life. In sum, during the whole time of the vie years of this king, much tranquillity, and as it were a breathing time, was granted to the whole Church of England, so that the rage of persecution, seizing, and the sword taken out of the adversary's hand, there was now no danger to the godly. Briefly, during all this time, neither in Smithfield nor any other quarter of this realm, any was hard to suffer for any matter of religion, either Papist or Protestant, either for one opinion or other." Since Fox was a Protestant, as most of his readers were also, presumably, his celebration of an interval in which neither Protestants nor Catholics were violently persecuted, as both had been at various times under Henry VIII, suggests a developing consensus in favor of this degree of toleration, at least. Jeanne d'Albret, who became the Queen of Navarre shortly after Edward's death, executed no one on religious grounds during her 17-year reign. She was an ally of Calvin's, and corresponded with him as Edward and Somerset had done. So in this regard, Cromwell might be thought of as part of an emerging movement, and also as engaged in the restoration of welcome reforms that Mary had swept away. There was an intellectual underground in England, a long tradition of radical thought that went back to John Wycliffe and William Langland, and emerged in the speeches of the common soldiers in Cromwell's army when they held their remarkable debates about the nature of the society that should emerge from the ruins of the old order. This tradition would have given the moment the tentative familiarity of an expectation fulfilled. Cromwell would certainly have been influenced by it, through long familiarity with the godly men, the plain russet-coated fellows who made up the solid core of his army. The English historian Christopher Hill argues that Milton was influenced by the thinkers of this underground. It is entirely probable that he was, not only because of its importance to the Revolution, but also because it was a deeply rooted literary tradition. Early in her reign, Queen Mary declared an inhibition by proclamation meant to deter dangers to her realm through diversity of opinions and questions of religion. It forbade unauthorized preaching and interpreting of scripture, and also playing of interludes and printing of false-found books, ballads, rhymes, and other lewd treatises in the English tongue, concerning doctrine, in matters now in question and controversy, touching the high points and mysteries of Christian religion, which books, ballads, rhymes, and treatises are chiefly by the printers and stationers set out to sell to her grace's subjects of an evil zeal for lucre and covetousness of vile gain. This is quoted by Fox, to whom these strictures would clearly apply, as they would also to John Day, the printer and publisher of many dissenting works, including the Acts and Monuments. Fox had remarkable access to documents far older and rarer than this one would have been, and his reports of them are highly consistent with their use by later and modern historians. So either his faithfulness to them is confirmed by others, or he is simply considered reliable, despite his being an apologist and polemicist for the faction whose zeal the Queen would like to inhibit. The kind of censorship called for by Mary was not unusual, though it was intermittent. Clearly nothing of comparable severity had been imposed by Cromwell, though we know from Milton's Areopagitica that Parliament did begin to require a licensing of books. Roger Lestrange, proposing a regime of censorship to be imposed by the newly restored Charles II after the fall of the Commonwealth, called for a reduction by 2/3 of the number of active printers, raids to seize prohibited books, whether new, republished, or concealed, rewards for informants who knew of the existence of forbidden books, and punishments for those informed upon, anyone involved in their making or distribution, including stitchers and carters. The ordinary penalties are proposed: death, mutilation, imprisonment, banishment, corporal pains, disgrace, pecuniary mulct. He says, for the authors, nothing can be too severe that stands with humanity and conscience. First, 'tis the way to cut off the fountain of our troubles. Secondly, there are not many of them in an age, and so the less work to do. He quotes treasonous views that are in print, for example this: princes derive their power and prerogative from the people, and have their investitures merely for the people's benefit. And this: kings are accountable to the people. I do not mean to the diffused humors and fancies of particular men in their single and natural capacities, but to the people in their politic constitution, lawfully assembled by their representative. Certainly there are better grounds for finding the basis of our laws in this suppressed and defeated Commonwealth movement, which contributed so largely to our early population, than to an elusive common law. In his introduction to the first volume of The Writings and Speeches of Oliver Cromwell, published in 1937, the Harvard historian W.C. Abbott says, "If Calvin's Institutes provided a logical system of theology to set against that of Rome, and his government of Geneva became a model state, his doctrines and practices combined to inspire an almost fanatical," that word again, "devotion among his followers. It is one of the greatest mysteries of the human spirit that a faith founded on the assumption that man's fate depends not on his own free will and acts, but was predestined from the beginning, should have moved its devotees not to supine inaction, but to deeds of heroism and self-sacrifice as vain as they were exalted, unless they were of peculiar grace elect among the rest." It is always fair to wonder if anyone, even a scholar as generally scrupulous as Abbott, has actually read the Institutes, and if he has, how he would define the words logical and system, very commonly invoked, or how, they being granted, they limb out a mystery that seems to him to make no sense at all. But this observation is nearly inevitable wherever any reference to Calvin and his influence is made. Perhaps by 1937 it was already mere reflex. It does not respond usefully to the fact, which he notes, that Calvin's influence is strongly, even uniquely, associated with potent activism. Here I will mention Lewis Tappan again, who was in fact fairly representative of his culture and his times. I could mention John Brown. Some light is shed on Abbott's mystery by the life of Cromwell himself, a man who, without training or experience, discovered at the age of 40 that he had a genius for the use of cavalry in battle, and beyond that for warfare, including the organization and control of a highly effective army, might really wonder how these things befell him. He might think in terms of fate, even if he were not theologically predisposed to. People in at all comparable circumstances often do. There are surprises in life that refuse to be understood in the simple terms of act and consequence. It seems reasonable to assume they come most frequently to those who throw themselves into the arms of fate or providence, rather than to those who proceed by calculation. Human estimates of the possible tend to be conservative, and our estimates of the effects of our actions and intentions are very far from reliable. It seems odd to me to think an act of heroism is vain if it does not count toward one's own everlasting benefit. Any reader of classical literature would know that heroism occurs among people who never think in terms like eternal salvation, and who really are fatalists. Again, however, this is just the little storm of perplexity that is always stirred up by the mention of Calvin, a figure of great importance in early modern history, as his mention here should remind us, who ought to be looked at seriously on these grounds alone. In any case, Abbott does quote, from the dedicatory letter that prefaces the Institutes, a passage that both justifies revolution and describes the form it should take. "Let us not think," wrote Calvin, "there is given no other commandment but to obey and suffer. I affirm that if they wink at kings willfully raging over and treading down the poor community, their dissembling is not without wicked breach of faith, because they dreadfully betray the people's liberty. It is odd in this context that